bonkers from jib to poop, tales of capitalism all at sea. So this is a small collection of maritime, or at least maritime adjacent stories, that I think here in their own way illustrate some of the bizarre and even ridiculous ways that humans behave within a capitalist market system that forces everyone to follow its directives, whether they want to or not, and whether they admit it or not. They have a maritime theme, no particular reason for that apart from coincidence, because they caught my eye, and because I like maritime stories. There were three stories, but then I came across a fourth recently, so, well, now there are four. I've called this talk Bonkers from Jib to Poop, which I suppose might be worth explaining, because dedicated landlubbers and people who've never read Patrick O'Brien or even Arthur Ransome might not know that a jib is the triangular sail at the front, or forecastle, of a ship, and the poop deck is, or was, at the back. Medieval Plantagenet-era warships used to have like a fortified structure at each end, a bit like crenellated wooden castles. They used to shoot arrows out of them. Obviously, that was in the days before cannons. And the forecastle became the forecastle. I'm not sure why the after castle didn't become the aft castle, except that it's hard to say. So instead it became the after deck, or the poop deck, or just aft. So to somewhat labour the joke in the title, capitalism is bonkers from stem to stern. The word poop, by the way, is from the Latin pupa, meaning a ship's stern. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with going to the toilet, even if you kind of intuitively suspect a rear-end connection. In the days of sail, when the crew wanted to do their number twos, they certainly didn't poop off the poop deck, just above the captain's cabin, but instead would hang perilously over the bowsprit in the prow where the jib is attached. And if your first thought is of all kinds of noxious and unsanitary blowback onto the ship's deck, you need to remember that the wind is coming from behind to fill the sails, not from in front. So the wind would flush any odours forwards and out to sea. So the first of these four stories is called Deep. If you think all I've just said is a bit nerdy, well, this first story is about just how nerdy you can be in capitalism when you've got hundreds of millions at your personal disposal. Just across the Severn estuary from Bristol is the town of Chepstow, on the mouth of the River Wye. There's an old flooded limestone quarry there. It's 80 metres deep, that's 260 feet. And it used to be a diving school. Today, it's the site of a multi-hundred-million-dollar project called Deep, funded by an unidentified oligarch whose purpose is to create futuristic habitable environments 200 metres, that's 650 feet, down on the sea floor that can be connected together like Duplo bricks. There's a full-scale habitat simulator at the quarry, where future undersea residents can train. There's a team of engineers and scientists, including a former NASA deep ocean researcher, and a campus. They even employ a chef who designs high-calorie meals because, and you might not know this, time spent underwater increases your metabolism. These meals are also very strongly flavoured because, and I bet you don't know this, high pressure suppresses your taste buds, so normal food doesn't taste of anything. The underwater habitats are called sentinels, and they're designed to comfortably house six people, who can travel down by submersible and go out on daily dives from the built-in dive port. The sentinels can also be relocated to observe different marine environments. I first heard about this project courtesy of a Guardian Science Weekly podcast. There's nothing secretive about it, but my first thought was, why? Why are they doing this? Their website at deep.com includes artist mock-ups and virtual tours, and explains Deep exists to radically advance how humankind can access, explore, and inhabit underwater environments. Through our mission, we hope to catalyze a renaissance in ocean exploration and research. My second thought was still, why? Deep refuses to say who its financial backer is, so the motive behind it is anyone's guess. Undersea exploration has been around for a long time, decades in fact, but has always rather played second fiddle to space exploration. Is this some nutty oligarch's version of Musk's desire to colonize other planets for the sake of human survival? Or is a baser, more capitalist incentive at work to plunder the marine environment? Jacques Cousteau first made the undersea world a hot topic in the 1960s, and he was funded by the oil industry. Or is it simply a modern folly, a monument to ego of the type that rich men through the ages have been wont to build for themselves? If we don't know what it's for, how do we know it's worthwhile? Nobody who doesn't work for Deep knows the answer to that. The opaqueness of it all is what's most troubling. A project sunk in depths of caginess that the sun can't reach. But there is one thing socialists can be pretty sure about. After capitalism has been and gone, and the world is managed in the only sensible way it can be, collectively and by all of us, no private individual is going to have the power or the resources to undertake a project like this just because they feel like it. They would first need evidence-based arguments to persuade a large number of others, including local communities, peer review boards, and so forth, that it was worth doing in the first place. One key indictment of capitalism and of capitalist science is that the rich can do any damn fool thing they like just because their money says so. The second story is called The Cruise That Never Was, from a BBC News article from the 4th of October 2025. And by an odd coincidence, I came across this news item while I was looking into this talk. The BBC article featured the luxury cruise's advertising slogan, which was, "Throw your current lifestyle overboard," which, as it turned out, was actually an invitation to throw nearly £3,000 a month overboard in return for a cruise ship cabin on a 3-year cruise to 115 countries. The deal was that you could stay on the cruise, going round and round as long as you like or until your money runs out. The marketing promised a fully fledged cruise liner that could house 1,350 guests with pools, tennis courts, and an Italian restaurant. Lots of people signed up and paid big deposits. Some even sold their houses, rehomed their cats, put their stuff into storage. All for a permanent life on the ocean wave. Except the ship never sailed. After 3 years, the company is still in dry dock with not enough customers, but still insists on advertising this increasingly improbable world cruise. It was last scheduled to set off in July 2025, but as of November, they haven't even booked a departure port or leased a ship. They do admit that they've had 132 cancellations, and they've investigated 38 complaints, but they insist that none of the 38 complaints are entitled to a refund due to administrative reasons, a point we shall return to later. When the customer started spreading the word on social media, aka bad-mouthing the company threatened legal action against them. The battle continues. Now, it would be a cheap shot to say, well, this is capitalism, you're going to get ripped off, what do you expect? But capitalism wouldn't last very long at all if every transaction was an obvious rip-off. There are ways that we are ripped off as workers, but they are far from being obvious. A better question is, what's the impact of these big cruises? Environmentally speaking, they're a catastrophe. A large cruise liner goes through 250 tons of fuel a day. They have been banned from a lot of ports like Venice and Nice because they block and pollute waterways. The ships disgorge hordes of tourists who overwhelm local infrastructure, causing huge disruption and congestion, but don't actually spend very much because they can eat and sleep on board ship. It's easy to understand why locals don't like it. It must feel like living in a zoo, mobbed by daily crowds who come to gawp at you and get in the way and then clear off again, leaving nothing but overflowing litter bins. I've never been on a cruise and probably wouldn't do it, but I can understand the appeal. Instead of travelling from hotel to see the sights, you bunk in a hotel that does your travelling for you. And besides, there's something seductive and alluring about the call of the sea, at least to urban dwellers, which is hard to resist. I did once work at a tour operator firm which had a partnership with the cruise line, and I found out an interesting thing. The staff at the cruise company told me, direct from the cabin cleaners, that the most commonly abandoned items post-cruise weren't socks or souvenirs or umbrellas, but sex toys. I was assured that this is common knowledge in the cruise line industry. I don't know what your image of the typical cruise clientele might be, but I must say this was a bit of a revelation to me. Given the enormous resource cost of today's cruise industry, it's hard to imagine that something like it would also occur in post-capitalist socialist society. Obviously, there would be no profit motive driving a cruise line industry, and no aggressive marketing to sell an expensive but short-lived fantasy experience. But people would still want to travel, wouldn't they? It doesn't matter why. It could be because of some atavistic impulse to sail off into the deep blue, or mere human curiosity, or just a hot lust for a floating orgy. If enough people wanted cruises in socialism, they would have to do the opportunity cost calculations. Resources, time and labour might be large, but they are finite. Would people want cruises more than, say, hospitals or integrated public transport? Maybe small cruises on sailing boats would be more doable, more environmentally friendly. Or maybe people wouldn't enjoy being that seasick. We don't know, of course. But universal free access in socialism doesn't mean you can have anything you want, like your own private castle or yacht. You can only have what society is cooperatively and collectively willing to make and maintain. If cruises are deemed an unjustifiable waste, then you'll be out of luck. Who knows, perhaps second-generation socialist society, having solved the biggest global deprivation problems, might turn out to be less puritanical and a bit more fun-oriented. The third story is called The Poop Cruise. So, yes, we're back to poop again, this time in the scatological, not the nautical sense, thus providing me with the double entendre of my title. You see what I did there? Poop is very much the keynote theme of a Netflix documentary in 2025 called Trainwreck Poop Cruise. This was about the no doubt traumatic, but also darkly comical calamity experienced by 4,200 passengers and crew who in 2013 actually did embark on a luxury liner from Galveston, Texas, across the Gulf of Mexico. Well, they set off, only to wish very quickly that they hadn't. This 13-story monster ship, hubristically named Carnival Triumph and described as a skyscraper on its side, had a fire in its engine room and stopped dead in the water halfway across the Gulf. All the power went out, including lights and air conditioning, all propulsion, all mobile phone connectivity and ship-to-shore communications. What was supposed to be a two-day luxury jaunt turned into a five-day humid and sweaty fever dream. It might have been tolerable in other circumstances, except that the toilets had electric flushes and had also stopped working. The crew had to think of something, so they proposed that number ones could be done in the shower and number twos in red biohazard bags, to be collected later by the lucky crew. As the passengers tell it, pooing into a bag was the worst nightmare they could possibly imagine, which prompted Lucy Mangan in her Guardian review to speculate that had the passengers not been American but British, the reaction to the prospect of shitting in a bag might have been somewhat less overwrought and possibly even quite humorous. I think she had a point. Americans, or at least the ones interviewed here, seem, well, if you'll pardon the expression, to lose their shit at the prospect of such an indignity. Whereas, I don't know, I imagine Europeans would be more stoical about it. Maybe nobody in America knows this, but almost half the world's population, 3.5 billion people, have no access to toilets at all and have to poo in plastic bags every day. Fortunately, the ship did have one working satellite phone with which to contact the shore and alert the world. It was immediately crisis mode, Carnival's PR department tells Netflix. You have to remember, a cruise ship is the biggest machine on the planet, and so when things go wrong, they typically go wrong in a big way. Not least for Carnival's PR department, as it turns out. Abundant food is one of the best-seller hallmarks of cruises. And, we shouldn't be surprised by now, there's also a lot of sex, including among the crew, as related by one Russian staff member who found herself in the wrong bed when the lights went out and the alarms went off. It happens, she explains, looking slightly sheepish. The kitchens can't cook, the freezers have packed up, all the perishables have to be thrown away, and people are queuing for 2 hours to get soggy tomato and lettuce sandwiches. And then people grab as much as they can and start hoarding. Says our adventurous Russian, laughingly. It made me think that, all these Americans somehow can feel what it was like in a dictatorship country where shit like this happens and it doesn't surprise anyone. Welcome to the Soviet Union, people. The decks turn into shanty towns and tent cities as people move bedding onto the decks to escape the suffocating interiors, because remember, there's no air conditioning. People start fighting over deck chairs and territory, going tribal and losing all dignity, while the crew desperately try to keep the peace. They must have wondered how long before the guests started painting their faces and fashioning spears. All this, and it's only been 2 days. The plan is to bring out a tugboat and get the ship to the nearest Mexican port by next day noon. But now it turns out that the ship has drifted 100 miles on the currents, well away from Mexico, so now it's going to take 3 more days to get help from Texas. The pumps don't work, so by now the showers are backing up, and the smell of urine and feces is filling the airless ship's interior. The ship's chef memorably describes the toilets. People were covering poop with toilet paper and then pooping on top of it, layer after layer, like a lasagna. In a bid to raise morale, the crew decide to open free bars, which turns out to be a huge mistake. People go crazy, fights break out, poo gets thrown around, people risk going overboard by weeing off the side. Drunk couples have sex openly on the deck. Finally, the tugboats arrive and start pulling. The weather, by now, has turned stormy and the ship tilts. All the backed-up feces and urine spill out along corridors, across carpets, down walls. It's literally raining sewage. Someone who has been enjoying the by-now wall-to-wall CNN news coverage is a maritime lawyer who knows all about the Carnival Cruise Line, the biggest in the world, and the fact that it has a track record of engine room fires. He then discovers many other preventable faults, including 9 fuel line failures in 2 years. He calls it playing Russian roulette with people's lives. He sets about litigation, hoping to make a mint on the basis that this was a disaster waiting to happen. But it turns out that the ticket contract contains a clause whereby the company, quote, makes absolutely no guarantee for safe passage, a seaworthy vessel, adequate and wholesome food, and sanitary and safe living conditions. Does the firm get away with this crafty bit of small print, which clearly nobody could have read before buying a ticket? No, it does not. The lawyer gets all his cases settled. Full refunds and free cruises are dished out to everyone on board, and the contract rewritten to remove this outrageous get-out clause. For a week in summer, this was the number one story in American media, so whether the company ultimately survives such terrible PR remains to be seen. Meanwhile, the chef says he'll never look at lasagna the same way again. The one bright note in all this is that the passengers universally seem to think that the crew did a wonderful, superhuman job in impossible conditions. A thing which certainly shouldn't surprise socialists. Workers, which is to say ordinary people, although to me the word ordinary feels diminishing, given that most people I've met are actually quite extraordinary. Those people are always the ones who go out of their way to help whenever there's a disaster, whether that's a natural disaster or just one caused by their own profit-obsessed employer. That's why we know that socialism will work, because ordinary, extraordinary people will be running it. My last story is the Satoshi seasteading story. What would a cruise look like if you left out the ticket-paying hoi polloi and reserved the cruise exclusively for the rich shipowners themselves and their friends? Well, there'd be no customers to shortchange, no customer service complaints, no corner-cutting or risk-taking to save money. You'd think it would be perfect. Well, you'd be wrong. For this last story, I'm indebted to The Guardian for their account of the disastrous voyage of the Satoshi, the world's first cryptocurrency cruise ship. So the thing to know about the rich is that they think they can have anything. All it takes is money. And a surprising thing to know is that the rich don't feel free. They chafe against all state restrictions and legislation that prevents them from doing just what they like. Well, why not invent their own state, free of all bureaucratic interference, not just in their imaginations, but located in physical property holdings somewhere? And where would that be? Where would one base this libertarian utopia? Not on land, because all the land on Earth is already spoken for, even the uninhabitable desert. But the ocean is another country, out there beyond state lines, in international waters, which, like outer space, belong to nobody. They could found their free-spirited colony out there, on a floating millionaire's playground. They even have a name for it, seasteading. Let a thousand nations bloom on the high seas, one enthusiast proclaims, with, as The Guardian puts it, Maoish zeal. Or rather, a thousand very tiny ship-sized nations, comprising only the super rich, with no rules except the Bacchic kind, and no head of state but hedonism. It needn't only be ships, enthused the sea evangelists. It could be permanent platforms or whole floating nomadic colonies. Other vessels might sail up and join in, or else float off somewhere else to found new civilizations. So who among these horizon-hopping visionaries would be first to slide down the slipway to launch a new life on the briny ocean as the jolliest of Jack Tars? Well, there were various short-lived attempts, most of which sank like the Lusitania, torpedoed by government Jobsworths. There was even one where the freedom-loving nauticals were chased away at high speed by pursuing gunboats. Then, in 2020, while the world was in lockdown, the travel and tourism industry shuddered to a halt, and many firms went into administration. But this ill wind provided a good following breeze for three crypto traders who were able to buy their own cruise ship at an ocean trench price, with the idea of parking it off the coast of Panama as a permanent new crypto community. They named the cruise ship Satoshi, because of course they did, as Satoshi Nakamoto is the god of crypto, the unidentified, quasi-mythical inventor of Bitcoin and the blockchain technology. The Satoshi would be the world's only environment completely devoid of statutory regulations, tedious customs and conventions, or limitations of any kind. A rule-free tax haven, like living on another planet, except with fish. Which illustrates something about the naivety of the rich. They simply don't understand why human societies have rules in the first place, because they think rules don't apply to them. Things seem to start off well. The Panama government seemed quite happy with the idea of a bunch of crypto dealers living off their coast tax-free, even seeing it as part of their sustainable tourism plans. The new ship owners advertised for volunteers to come aboard and do their own tax-free crypto mining. 777 cabins were to be auctioned off at various prices depending on ocean view, balconies, and so on and so forth. The venture soon garnered interest and a few questions. Where was the power going to come from to do all this mining, as well as power the ship? What about internet? What about COVID? Or food and water? And toilet facilities? Oh yeah, because they're important. Could you take pets? The owners tried to answer all these questions. Power would have to come from generators at first, they said. Later, solar. Wi-Fi would have to be land-based and priced into the fees. Then they could meter it. Special medical staff would be on hand to keep the ship COVID-free. But it turns out you can't just buy a cruise ship and do whatever you like. They come with health and safety rules. No cooking was allowed in cabins. Everyone would have to buy food at the onboard restaurant. The more the owners dug into the questions, the more they were forced to consider possible passenger conflicts, and the more rules they had to invent. Pets had to meet a stringent 14-point set of conditions, including maximum weight. Dogs must be housed in balcony cabins only, with a special porch potty and a basket of fake grass to wee on. Pet waste chucked overboard was subject to a $200 fine. Excessive barking was subject to being put off the ship. The unlimited, rule-free lifestyle the ship owners had envisaged began to be hemmed in by compromise after compromise. Obviously, the crypto kids knew nothing about sailing, so they hired a 40-person crew and an experienced cruise liner captain, who immediately set about explaining realities to them. Firstly, you have to have a certificate of seaworthiness before you're allowed to set off on a cruise, and the Satoshi's certificate had just expired. A small detail which nobody had thought to check before signing contracts. So before they could cross the Atlantic, they had to shunt to Gibraltar and into dry dock for repairs in order to get the certificate. They finally set off across the Atlantic, delighted to discover that their purchase also included a stock of 5,000 bottles of wine and 2,000 bottles of spirits, which they were happy to allow the crew to enjoy for free, until the captain sensibly limited them to 3 slugs of grog a day. Otherwise, he said, I'd have no crew. The plan was to anchor off the Panama coast and then deregister the vessel as a ship, and instead register it as a floating residence, the idea being to get around the restrictions of maritime law. But Panama wasn't having that. it insisted the Satoshi remain a ship. They also weren't going to allow the ship to discharge any sewage, so it would have to sail 12 miles out into international waters every 20 days if it wanted to do that. All of this caused problems for insurers, who were nervous about the whole enterprise. What the crypto kids had failed to grasp was that, quote, the high seas, while appearing borderless and free, are in fact some of the most tightly regulated places on Earth. The captain pointed out to the innocent crypto kids that the cruise industry was one of the top three most regulated industries, along with nuclear power and airlines. As The Guardian put it, this attempt at an escape from oppressive rules and bureaucracy was being hobbled by oppressive rules and bureaucracy. Fuel for the journey across the Atlantic was costing $12,000 a day, but even when they eventually parked on the Panamanian coast, they would still have to keep paying the ship's crew because even when docked, a cruise ship can cost up to $1 million a month to maintain. The crypto kids were always having adventurous ideas, though. Not for nothing were they the new breed of digital entrepreneurs. Could they cut a hole in the ship and swap out the engine for a smaller, more efficient one? The captain seems to have showed admirable restraint. "How are you going to cut a hole in the ship's side?" he said. "Big enough to get the engine out, which is below water level, and not sink the ship." To every harebrained idea of theirs, he sadly shook his head. "No, you can't do that." They still couldn't solve the insurance problem either, and now they had another problem. The cabins weren't selling. What with all the onboard rules, and the cost, and the small size of the cabins, and the tiny size of the toilets, and the ban on home cooking, the whole proposition looked less like a punter's paradise and more like a floating prison. Halfway across the Atlantic and past the point of no return, they came to the reluctant conclusion that the whole venture was a busted flush and that they'd have to try and cut their losses and sell the ship. But they'd got it dirt cheap because nobody was buying cruise ships. The tragic realization dawned that they might have to sell their luxury dream liner for scrap. Even this didn't work. They got a scrap deal from a ship breakers yard in India, but the deal fell through due to regulations about the disposal of hazardous waste in countries not covered by something called the Basel Convention. But then, by a miracle, a new cruise line, one that also took advantage of the bargain basement prices due to the COVID-induced trashing of the travel industry, a new cruise line came forward with a low offer. It wasn't really enough to cover all their costs, but at least they didn't have to go down with all hands. As The Guardian tells it, the crypto kids haven't lost their enthusiasm, though. Now they're working on building sea pods, bizarre habitations that stick out of the water and have to be supplied by drone from the air. They seem convinced that there'll be buyers, although I can't imagine who would be lunatic enough to want to live in a cell on a stalk in the ocean, where even walking a few steps would be impossible. The Satoshi, meanwhile, has been renamed the Ambiance, spruced up for traditional cruises for the over-50s. And where cryptocurrencies, the new owners say, will not be accepted at the bar. Is there a conclusion from any of this? The Deep Project funded by the secret billionaire? The cruise that never sailed? The cruise that did sail and then broke down mid-ocean? The cruise that showcased how move fast and break things frequently just means blunder about and cause chaos? And how some rich people have a cartoon concept of liberty precisely because they have no real connection to or understanding of the real lives of the poor majority. There's no coda here to tie it all up in a pretty bow. If there's any kind of takeaway, maybe it's just the absurdity of a money-driven machine that floats on a deep ocean of absurdities. Or maybe, to sign off with just one more feeble pun, this is all just navel-gazing.
You have been listening to World Socialist Radio, produced by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. To find out more and to take out a free trial subscription to the Socialist Standard, visit spgb.net/podcast.